I'm Alyssa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. As of Friday morning, more than 2 million Floridians are still without power in the wake of Hurricane Ian, with the storm continuing to crawl up the mid-Atlantic. Now, Ian had come ashore Wednesday on Florida's Gulf Coast as a nearly Category 5 hurricane, one of the strongest storms ever to hit the U.S. It flooded homes on both of the state's coasts, cut off the only road access to a barrier island, destroyed a historic waterfront pier, and knocked out electricity to nearly a quarter of the state's utility customers. About 600 miles away from Tampa, Florida, schools are closed across the Piedmont region of North Carolina. I know this because this is where I live, and my kid is out of school on Friday, and we're bracing for high winds and rain. And that so many can be affected by a single event like Ian, it's perhaps just another reminder of how connected we really are. 39 days from the midterm elections, and a lot of politics, well, it feels very local. Voters are choosing school boards. They're determining county commissions. They're shuffling up who is serving as sheriff, and they're determining the best representatives for sewer, water, and levy boards. But as local as these elections are, we are nonetheless connected. Just 39 days away from the final day to cast a vote in the midterm elections, it is possible to see some big trends within all this disparate local campaigning. And one of those shared through lines is the diversity of the candidate pool. According to a new analysis released this week by our partners at the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers, more women ran for governor, the U.S. Senate and House, and state legislatures in this election cycle than ever before. And according to the Victory Fund, LGBTQ plus candidates for the U.S. Congress and transgender candidates overall reached record numbers as well. So let's figure out what it all means for all of us. Political strategist Aisha Mills is here. She was recently a candidate for New York's 18th Congressional District. Aisha, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hi, Melissa. Glad to be with you.
Absolutely. So happy to have you. And Maria Cardona, CNN political commentator and Democratic strategist and principal of the Dewey Square Group, is also with us. Maria, welcome to The Takeaway.
Melissa, so great to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Aisha, I want to start with you because you were president and CEO of the LGBTQ Victory Fund, which works to elect LGBTQ people up and down the ballot, which so I kind of feel like, good job. You planted some seeds there. We're seeing this record year. Talk to me a little bit about the races that you are watching most closely this year.
Well, let me just start by saying, Melissa, you're right. There were seeds planted that have led us to this place where we literally have the most diverse Congress that we've ever had in history. And we're also seeing, you know, the most diverse state legislatures than we've ever had in history. And it's because there has been a multi-decade strategy to train, to recruit, to develop, to invest in people to be public servants. Now, I ran the organization, the LGBTQ Victory Fund, which did the pipeline building for LGBTQ folks. And we're now over 800 out elected people all across the country because of that work. But Emily's List has been doing this pipelining for women for many, many, many years, over 20 years. There's also the Latino Victory Fund that is doing this for Latino candidates. So I want to just start off our conversation by letting everyone know that while there are a bounty of amazing people in communities who have been doing the Lord's work of public service in their own ways that step up and answer the call to run for office, there also is a organizational structure that would it have not been for many of these groups who go out and support these candidates who are frankly underdogs most of the time, that actually got us here and is pushing forward for structural change. I am always watching to see, of course, which queer candidates are going to be able to break through first the establishment and the establishment coffers and get the establishment head nod. And then to see how they might do in the broader sense of the general election. I line it up that way because my experience has been that the first challenge for diverse candidates is actually getting taken seriously by those who hold the purse strings and those who control the political establishment where they are. So one candidate
I want to pause right there because it's such an important insight, and I don't want to go too quickly past it because I think it, you know, there is a way kind of in media that we talk about elections as though it is, you know, voters making decisions on candidates. And yes, right. But even sort of the framework for which candidates you get to make a decision between, right, is set with all of these other prior decision makers, right? Parties that nominate or don't, right? Those who give to campaigns or choose not to, right? All of these sort of intermediary decision makers who determine in part the viability of a candidate before that candidate ends up on a general election ballot for voters to make a choice between.
Exactly. And the truth is that some of that inside baseball that we're talking about, that party politicking, is what makes it difficult for people who are most connected to the pain, as Ayanna Pressley says, to even jump into the fray and be of service to their communities. But it also does help in pushing forth the handful that are deemed to, quote unquote, be viable and give them the resources to win. So yeah, I think about my friend Leslie Harrod, who is running for mayor in Denver, Colorado, who is probably going to win and be the first Black woman and Black lesbian to serve there in Denver. She's been doing amazing work. She also has the backing of the LGBT community, the Democratic establishment writ large, the governor there, who also happens to be a gay man. And so Leslie has really positioned herself to be competitive, fundraising and otherwise, just throughout her career. I, on the other hand, when I was running this summer here in New York's Hudson Valley, ended up in a redistricting conundrum where I was running for the current DCCC chairman's seat that he has vacated because he's running elsewhere due to redistricting. And he handpicked who was going to be his successor, if that makes sense. And the consequence of that is that I was the anti-establishment candidate and didn't win the primary for a lot of reasons. But certainly from a fundraising standpoint and a messaging standpoint, you know, ended up being against an establishment that raised me, that I grew up in. And like, you know, we talked about, I ran various organizations helping hundreds of other people get elected. So the political wins are not certainly, you know, just about the voters, unfortunately, because if they were, then we would probably have even more diverse representation than we do now.
So, Maria, let me follow up on this sort of table here that that Aisha is setting for us. And maybe you can help us see that within the context of sort of broader Democratic Party politics here. I mean, we had, for example, six Black women who threw their hat in the ring to be governor of their state, which is, you know, in a country that has never had a Black woman serve as governor. But some of them have struggled with exactly this establishment, right, in terms of finding that they're, you know, being pushed, promoted, amplified by the Democratic Party in the same ways that some of their colleagues who have also relative, you know, political newcomers, but who are not Black women, have been able to find support.
That's absolutely the case. And look, I mean, let's just say the reality here, which is, first of all, change is hard. And secondly, when you are looking at a trend that is different, which is Black women running, Latina women running, LGBTQ candidates running, it scares a lot of people, right? There's still a lot of people who are not comfortable with that. And, you know, some of it is racism, some of it is conscious, some of it is subconscious. And that's what the trend that we all see that we know is good for this country, which is more diverse candidates representing what has become a more diverse demographic in this country. That's good. But having that change, especially within the establishment, even the Democratic establishment, has been tough. And so I commend Aisha and all of the groups that are doing such amazing work to make sure that candidates, diverse candidates across the board, are prepared for when they want to take those steps, because that is incredibly important. But the other thing I would say is that the reason I think that we have so many diverse candidates running this time around is because you have the intersection between candidates who have been preparing with all the groundwork that Aisha and the other groups have been involved in for so many years. And then you have the political climate, right? Because people aren't going to run for office if they think things are hunky-dory for them, right? We saw in 2017 when Trump was elected, that year, even though Emily's List and so many women's groups had been doing such incredible work in getting women to run in years prior, we suddenly saw a barrage of women the way we've never seen them before run for office. And why was it? Because they felt threatened. They felt threatened to their core. It was existential. And I really think that is a big reason why so many additional diverse candidates are running this time around. They are threatened. I know Latinos feel threatened. I know LGBTQ communities feel threatened. And so you have people stepping out from those communities saying, we're going to take the reins. We're going to run. We're going to be the ones at these tables of power making these decisions for our communities. We're not going to take it anymore. And so I think the confluence of those two things are what has led us to this moment. And even though some of that change comes from a negative place because people don't see the country going in the right direction for their communities, I think the result is incredibly positive for the country.
Maria, I'm wondering, you know, in that sense of threat, because there is that, there's that challenge between both, you know, sort of amplifying or moving people because of a sense of threat, but also a sense of hope or efficacy. And you were just coming to it towards the end there. I do wonder if for many voters and communities, the threat feels real, but maybe mm-hmm. the sense of solution doesn't. And so that's where I want to pick up. As soon as we get back, we're going to come back. We are still going to be talking with Aisha Mills, political strategist and former candidate for New York's 18th Congressional District, and with Maria Cardona, who's CNN political commentator. We're going to keep talking about this sense of threat and hope. Maria, be ready for me as soon as we get back.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
Thanks for sticking with us on The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and we're continuing our conversation about the diverse pool of candidates in this year's midterm elections. Now, according to the Brookings Institution, 72% of Republicans running for Congress this year are white, whereas less than half of Democratic candidates are white. We're back now with CNN political commentator Maria Cardona and political strategist Aisha Mills. So Maria, before the break, we were talking about this notion of hope or efficacy along with this concern about threat. What are you seeing about sort of where folks are in that space?
I think that there is a healthy combination of both, Melissa, because you're right. I think that people aren't going to jump into the ring if they don't feel hopeful that they are the ones that can bring the change that's necessary to their community. So there certainly is that hope, that aspiration, that while they might not see things in the best light for their communities or the direction of their communities in this country going the way that they see it, they do still see the promise of this country in terms of it being the one with the opportunities, the greatest country in the world. If you step up and you do things according to the laws, well, most laws anyway, and I think that's part of the point, right? For people running, sometimes they see those laws are unjust and they want to change them. But the core of that is that positivity that hopefulness, that aspiration that they can make the changes that are necessary. And that is a blessing still that we have in this country. That doesn't exist in every country in the world. And so you do have that, I think, an important combination of understanding that it's going to be difficult, because clearly the stats are that it is still much more difficult for a diverse candidate to get the support that they need from the establishment to raise that money, to make a name for themselves, to be able to be successful in a run for office, than it is for white candidates. That is still a reality in this country. At the same time, we are at a historic moment where more diverse candidates are stepping up to the plate than ever before. And so I am proud that it's the Democratic Party that has celebrated these diverse candidates, even though sometimes we ourselves have to make sure to make room for those diverse candidates, to bring them into the process. And this is where so many groups that have done exactly that, make sure they have the training, make sure they know how to raise money, make sure they have funders that are ready to support them, because it's not easy. It is not easy to run for office in this country. And so I still think we have a long way to go for candidates and then for elected officials up and down the ballots to actually represent the communities that they come from. But I think that we're making great strides.
All right. On just that, I want to come, Aisha. So first of all, Aisha, I want you to come on down south with me, not just metaphorically, but anytime. Come on down. Visit us here in North Carolina, because I'd love to get your take on this U.S. Senate race going on in North Carolina right now between Ted Budd, who is the Republican nominee, and Sherry Beasley, who is the African-American woman nominee. And Sherry Beasley is running, you know, just for folks who may not know, Sherry Beasley is actually coming out of the courts. She had served for a short time as the Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court. And she's running this very interesting kind of deracialized and departisan campaign that feels very much like her judge identity, right? She's got a recent campaign commercial where she's been endorsed by multiple male judges from the court, from different ideological backgrounds. And what they're saying about her is she's not an ideologue. She's not a partisan. Which strikes me as a fascinating strategy in this particular social and political moment. So I'm really interested to know what you think, Aisha, to the extent that you've been following this Senate race.
Yeah, Melissa, your observations are just always so spot on and astute. I, too, have raised my eyebrow in curiosity around the, I'm going to call it kind of sanitizing of her candidacy in a way. At least that's how it looks from a national lens to me, especially because in contrast to, say, Stacey Abrams being on a ballot right now, looking at Mandela Barnes's Senate race that is super exciting. And, you know, out there in Milwaukee, it's just so progressive in Wisconsin, and he's getting a lot of flair and energy. It seems to me that her race is very is designed to be very neutral, even though she's competing as a Democrat. And I don't know why that has been the strategic thought process. Do folks think that a Black woman can't win statewide in North Carolina and thus are trying to, you know, make her as sobering as possible for those who might, you know, feel anxious about her? I'm not sure, but I'll tell you this, because I get her emails and I get her fundraising text messages. She is coming across very differently in the fundraising fury of the narrative than what we see in the public stump speeching, day-to-day campaigning, and media coverage. And so I always wonder how it ultimately will play out when there are really two different types of energies and narratives spewing out, one from fundraising, which is very, the sky is going to fall if you don't elect me, we need Democrats to control the Senate, like I can do this kind of thing, versus how, you know, someone is showing up with actual voters. It seems to me that the authenticity across the board, and I use Mandela Barnes to contrast just watching his campaign, is what works, and that people can kind of sniff through it. I am very disappointed that Democrats are not jumping up and down and doing more to support her. One, I'm a little bit biased because I think that Black women will save us. So I do believe that someone who has been so above the fray or outside of the fray of the nasty vitriol of partisan politics just by virtue of her being a Supreme Court judge, right? It seems to me to be the type of person that we should be getting behind. But, you know, the Democrats do what the Democrats do, and I hope that we are not disappointed come November because of the lack of enthusiasm around her.
Asia, let me come back to you just real quick on this one and ask about media and the intersection of media coverage of LGBTQ plus and particularly LGBTQ plus of color candidates. Has media gotten any better about how we talk about, think about and position these candidates?
Ooh, well, that's always, it depends on who the media is at any point in time. But I would say that certainly the mainstreaming of LGBTQ candidates, queer people of color, especially, has been really important. And also just culture breaking and culture making in terms of shifting people's ideas about what an elected official looks like. And the media is to thank for a lot of that. There was a great piece on Odessa Kelly, who was running down in Tennessee for Congress in a very, you know, gerrymandered district, which makes it a little bit tough for her. But the Washington Post did a great write-up talking about her as a mother, as an activist, as an organizer, but then certainly also as a candidate. And she also happens to be a very tall, former basketball playing, masculine, you know, presenting queer person. I think that that is very helpful. I will say, though, Melissa, to your point about media, it seems to me that we're also in a place where, because of the media coverage around the pain, all of the issues, be it with policing, be it George Floyd or Breonna Taylor, as well as the pseudo celebrity of leaders of the Black Lives Matter movement over the last decade or so, I think that people are also seeing hope in the opportunity to have resistance and to also be a part of structural change. And that's why we're seeing a new generation jump into the fray as well, because part of the 80s and 90s felt like a big lull of Congressional Black Caucus doing whatever it was doing that was not necessarily connected to the day-to-day experience of communities of color's lives. And now we're seeing movements rise up that are really challenging power systems. And I believe it's inspiring people. And you see that in the media to also step up to the plate because they believe that public service can be a lever of change. Again, it's like a bit of a renaissance, I think.
Now, Maria, I also want to come to you on, you know, maybe it's the way the media talks about these moments. But as much as we've talked about Democrats having this diverse slate, it is not all on the Democratic side. You know, one of the sort of media discourses this year is the red wave of Latina candidates, right? A surge in Republican Latinas vying for congressional seats, many of them in Texas. I'm fascinated by this phenomenon that's occurring. Can you speak to it a bit?
Sure. And I'll say that as a Latina, I think it's wonderful. I think the more Latinas step up to the plate to represent the community in either party or even as independents, I think is good for the Latino community, is good for the country, the Latino community, as frankly are a lot of the diverse communities in this country, are exactly that. They're diverse within those communities. We're not all monolithic. And so I think that's great. As a Democrat, I will say that the Democratic Party needs to continue to step up to the plate and to talk to Latinos across the country about why we believe it's our party that represents their interests. Because when we don't do that, and if we don't do that, then Republicans are going to try to step into the fray.
Maria Cardona is a CNN political commentator and political strategist. Aisha Mills is also a political strategist and did that hard work of running for office very recently in a New York congressional race. Thank you both for coming on The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Thank you.